Thank you for your introduction. Let me begin on a subjective note. First, I would like to express on this occasion my gratitude for all the inspiration and support that Georg Heinrich von Wright has given me over the years. It was he who, in the early 1970s, introduced me to the Wittgenstein Nachlass, encouraged me to work on it, and made it possible for me to pursue this work. Secondly, I want to say that with the publication of the Bergen Electronic Edition, working with the Nachlass has not just become easier, but, for me at least, has become a radically different enterprise, even more exciting and rewarding than before, promising to cast new light on many strands on Wittgenstein's philosophy. And one such strand is Wittgenstein's philosophy of pictures. To this I now turn. Wittgenstein's philosophy of pictures is commonly regarded as comprising two contrasting positions. The Tractatus is taken to argue for a picture theory of meaning, summed up by Wittgenstein's diction, the proposition is a picture of reality. The later Wittgenstein is interpreted as holding a use theory of pictures, according to which pictures by themselves do not carry any meaning. They acquire meaning by being put to specific uses and by being applied in specific contexts. Those uses and contexts are defined by language. Pictures are subservient to words, and indeed not even mental images mean by virtue of their resemblance to some external reality. Now, of course, neither the early nor the later views of Wittgenstein on picturing are as straightforward as common opinion suggests. Recall the Tractarian notion of the abbildende Beziehung, or pictorial relationship, a relationship consisting of, quote, the correlation of the picture's elements with things. This pictorial relationship has exactly the same function as the later concept of a method of projection. The idea of convention is there in the Tractatus too. Nor is the idea of resemblance missing from the investigations. The standard opinion did not go uncontested. In 1973 already, Kenley emphasized that, quote, the picture theory needs supplementing rather than being false. The theory of meanings as use is a complement rather than a rival to the picture theory. The discontinuity view, however, remains predominant. Wittgenstein's later philosophy of pictures has been taken note of in the so-called imagery debate. Wittgenstein here stands for the view that pictures without a verbal interpretation cannot carry meaning. Beyond the boundaries of the imagery debate, Wittgenstein's later philosophy of pictures has not received much attention. Thus, from the very extended discussions surrounding Goodman's Languages of Art, Wittgenstein's name is practically absent. Wittgenstein's name is practically absent, even though one of the first reviewers of the work, Richard Waldheim, did to some extent rely on Wittgenstein. My suggestion is that the relative lack of interest in Wittgenstein's later philosophy of pictures is not independent of the fact that his full Nachlass was, until the publication of the Bergen Electronic Edition, not actually available. The printed corpus only partially conveys the richness, complexities, continuities of, and changes in Wittgenstein's ideas on pictorial representation. And it fails to convey the significance of the later Wittgenstein's method of explaining philosophical points with the help of diagrams. His Nachlass contains some 1,300 of them. This method would have made no sense if he had really adhered to the position that images do not have a meaning unless interpreted verbally. What picture of Wittgenstein's philosophy of pictures does there emerge from his printed work? I will deal with some of the more important volumes one by one. No attempt at completeness is made, and I am taking only the most significant passages into account. First, the philosophical investigation. The picture theme makes its appearance at the very beginning of the volume, in the 1945 preface, immediately after the passage explaining that the author has at long last been forced to give up the idea of writing a proper book, the idea of composing extended texts which would progress in a linear order, and that this has to do with the nature of the task itself. Instead, he has produced an album, made up of ever new pictures of the same size. The first picture is a metaphor here, but the metaphor, entirely absent in the 1938 version of the preface, is quite elaborate, the author likening himself to a poor draftsman with references made to picture cuts and to observers of landscapes. And the difference between pictures and unidirectional texts is real enough. Wittgenstein, in fact, seems to suggest that the written text is an inappropriate medium in which to conduct his specific investigations. Towards the end of my talk, I will formulate a hypothesis as to why this might actually be the case. In the so-called part one of philosophical investigations, the insertion at paragraph 22 gives the example of a picture representing a boxer, that can be used to convey various meanings. Pictures, or some pictures at least, are not self-explanatory. Paragraph 23 introduces the concept of language games, relates this concept to that of a form of life, and lists a number of language games. One of them is constructing an object from a description, a drawing. Wittgenstein does not explicitly say so here, but he clearly implies that one needs training, that one has to become acquainted with the workings of an institution in order to be able to construct an object from a drawing. Later, in a similar vein, paragraphs 139 to 141 jointly suggest that it is not the single picture, but rather the institution of how we use pictures that is decisive. Paragraph 291 contrasts a blueprint with those pictures, quote, which seem simply to portray how a thing looks. Such pictures, Wittgenstein says, are, as it were, idle. Pictures, just like words, can serve as instruments. Paragraphs 432 to 434 introduce the idea of gestures as pictures and suggest that only use gives life to pictures. In paragraph 449, there occurs an intriguing passage, quote, we do not realize that we calculate, operate with words, and in the course of time translate them sometimes into one picture, sometimes into another. Paragraph 580 applies to the painting of pictures the Platonic riddle of the unthinkable non-existent, and concludes with the far-reaching question, well, tell me what the object of painting is, the painting of a man, for example, or the man that the picture portrays. The issue reverberates in paragraph 520 with Wittgenstein's imaginary interlocutor saying that, quote, a painting or relief or film can at any rate not set forth what is not the case. Paragraph 522 introduces the distinction between a portrait, a historical representation, and a genre picture. When I look at a genre picture, Wittgenstein writes, it tells me something even though I don't believe, imagine, for a moment, that the people I see in it really exist, or that there have really been people in that situation. But suppose I ask, what does it tell me then? The answer is given in paragraph 523, quote, I should like to say, what the picture tells me is itself, that is, it's telling me something consists in its own structure, in its own lines and colors, unquote. The idea that pictures need to be backed by words in order to be unequivocal is entirely missing here. It reappears in paragraphs 663 and 683. We now come to part one of philosophical investigations. Here Wittgenstein, in section 11, begins by pointing out that texts supply interpretations of illustrations, but adds that with each different interpretation, we really see the illustration differently. The idea of a picture object is introduced. Wittgenstein gives the example of a picture face and remarks, in some respects, I stand towards it as I do towards a human face. I can study its expression, can react to it as to the expression of the human face. A child can talk to picture men or picture animals, can treat them as it treats dolls. More than once, Wittgenstein returns to the question of how it is possible, quote, to see an object according to an interpretation. And more, he tends to reject rather than to answer this question. There is just no queer fact that would stand in need of explanation. There are pictures we do not interpret at all, but react to, as Wittgenstein puts it, in an immediate way. Whether we do so react might be a question of, quote, custom and upbringing. Grappling with the problem of seeing as, Wittgenstein discusses the figure of the double cross. This can be seen either as a white cross on a black ground or a black cross on a white ground. The two aspects of the figure could be called attention to, he writes, simply by pointing alternately to an isolated white and an isolated black cross. And Wittgenstein adds, quote, one could quite well imagine this as a primitive reaction in a child, even before it could talk, unquote. Here we have, then, a case where understanding a picture is entirely independent of language use. From the philosophical investigations, there does not emerge a unified philosophy of pictures. The remarks in part one embody viewpoints markedly different from those in part two. This is, of course, what one would expect. Von Wright's observations, according to which, quote, Wittgenstein's writings from 1946 onwards represent in certain ways departures in new directions, applies to the remarks pertaining to pictorial meaning too. Those in part two tend to accept the possibility of autonomous pictorial representation. Those in part one tend to reject it. But, as must have become clear from the foregoing, neither part two nor especially part one do even by themselves convey a really coherent view. Let's turn to the philosophical remarks. The bulk of this book is a more or less faithful edition of TS-209, which in turn is based on manuscripts written by Wittgenstein in 1929 and in the first half of 1930. The book contains quite a number of remarks mentioning pictures. However, the remarks are occasional, random. Wittgenstein at this time was clearly not concerned with working towards anything like a theory of pictorial meaning. On pages 53 and 54, there is a passage containing two interesting remarks. First, when a child thinks, quote, it forms for itself pictures that are arbitrary, quote, insofar as other pictures could have played the same role. Secondly, quote, of course, the thought processes of an ordinary man consists of a medley of symbols, of which the strictly linguistic perhaps form only a small part. On page 73, we encounter the interesting passage, quote, Our ordinary language has no means for describing a particular shade of color, such as the brown of my table. Thus, it is incapable of producing a picture of this color. On page 115, general propositions are likened to incomplete pictures. And on the next page, the possibility of expressing negation by means of incomplete pictures is explored. These are momentous ideas, but Wittgenstein does not further pursue them. In contrast to the philosophical remarks, the volume entitled Philosophical Grammar contains extended and focused passages pertaining to problems of pictorial meaning. I have discussed them in some detail in the complete version of my present talk. Here, I have to restrict myself to referring to just a few passages and showing some others. On page 163 of Philosophical Grammar, there are two striking remarks. Quote, anything can be a picture of anything if we extend the concept of picture sufficiently. And, quote, thinking is quite comparable to the drawing of pictures. On page 164, we read, if we compare a proposition with a picture, we must think whether we are comparing it to a portrait, a historical representation, or to a genre picture. And both comparisons have point. On the same page, there is this important remark. For a picture to tell me something, it isn't essential that the words should occur to me while I look at it. Because the picture should be the more direct language. That then follows on page 165, quote, what the picture tells me is itself. It's telling me something will consist in my recognizing in it objects in some sort of characteristic arrangement, unquote. The phrase, the picture tells me itself, repeatedly occurs on the subsequent pages. On page 179, there is the remark, think of the multifariousness of what we call language. Word language, picture language, gesture language, sound language. On page 182, there follows a crucial passage, quote, if one takes it as obvious that a man takes pleasure in his own fantasies, let it be remembered that fantasy does not correspond to a painted picture, to a sculpture or a film, but to a complicated formation out of heterogeneous components, words, pictures, and so on. Then one will not contrast operating with written and spoken signs with operating with imagination pictures of events. The ugliness of a human being can repel in a picture, in a painting, as in reality, but so it can too in a description in words. End of quote. Based on the fuller analyses elaborated in the complete version of my paper, I would sum up the state of Wittgenstein's philosophy of pictures in the philosophical grammar as follows. The idea of institutional embeddedness of picture use is not yet prominent, but otherwise, all the familiar elements of Wittgenstein's thinking on the topic are more or less present. However, these elements do not make up a coherent whole. The contradictions are not resolved. The philosophical grammar does certainly not encourage any systematic interpretation. And how could it? By 1976, the latest, the year the von Wright Festschrift containing Candy's From the Big Typescript to the Philosophical Grammar was published, recall Sir Anthony's talk on Thursday, it must have become clear that this volume is a misedited aggregate of various separate unfinished texts, not anything Wittgenstein in this form would have or in this would have put together. In the Blue Book, Wittgenstein focuses on problems of meaning and intention. The few remarks on pictures arise mainly in connection with the leitmotif, quote, we could perfectly well, for our purposes, replace every process of imagining by a process of looking at an object or by painting, drawing, or modeling. On page 32, Wittgenstein puts the question, what makes a portrait of Mr. N? The answer, he writes, which might first suggest itself, is the similarity between the portrait and Mr. N. It is quite clear, however, Wittgenstein points out, that, quote, similarity does not constitute our idea of a portrait, for it is in the essence of this idea that it should make sense to talk of a good or a bad portrait. On the other hand, for instance, the painter might have been told to paint a portrait of N. In this case, it is words, together with the picture, that makes the portrait a portrait of N. On page 36, Wittgenstein calls attention to the possibility of, quote, a picture which we don't interpret in order to understand it, but which we understand without interpreting it. There are, he writes, quote, pictures of which we should say that we interpret them, that is, translate them into a different kind of picture in order to understand them, and pictures of which we should say that we understand them immediately without any further interpretation. Later, in this rather exceptional passage, Wittgenstein acknowledges that there occur mental images making up, as it were, a pictorial language, and continues by introducing the notion of a picture by similarity. The focus of the Brown Book is on language games. References to pictures here enter as illustrations of specific aspects of language use. Wittgenstein mentions cases where the pointing gesture is, quote, part of the practice of communication itself, page 80, and tables, quote, in which written signs are placed opposite to pictures of objects, page 82, and remarks that such gestures or pictures are, quote, elements or instruments of language, page 84. On page 105, a pictorial language is introduced involving two sequences of images running in parallel to each other in such a way as to provide for a primitive kind of narration of past events. It consists of a sun series representing the passage of time during the day and of life pictures showing the activities of a child. The two rows of pictures, when properly correlated, tell the story of a child's day. Wittgenstein certainly implies here that this would be a feasible child language, that the child could learn to think in such a language. Another type of autonomous pictorial communication is described on page 125. The facial characteristics of a certain family could be shown by a proper arrangement of a set of family portraits. We have now come to the point in the Brown Book at which Wittgenstein in 1936 gave up making a German version of the text. A fact Rush Rees, in his 1958 preface, registers with a, for him, unusual editorial precision. Wittgenstein, at this point, after making a passing reference to the possibility of describing the position of an object, quote, by words or pictures, on page 162 again touches on the issue of facial characteristics and expressions. He asks us, quote, to contemplate the expression of a face primitively drawn in this way. We should let this face, Wittgenstein writes, produce an impression on us. We will then say, surely I don't see mere dashes, I see a face with a particular expression. And the point Wittgenstein here makes is that we cannot actually explain what this particular expression consists in. As he puts it, quotes, quote, words can't exactly describe it, one sometimes says. And yet one feels that what one calls the expression of the face is something that can be detached from the drawing of the face. It is as though we could say, this face has a particular expression, namely this, pointing to something. But if I had to point to anything in this place, it would have to be the drawing I'm looking at, end of quote. One has an experience here, Wittgenstein implies, which cannot be conveyed by words, although it can be conveyed by pointing to a drawing. It appears our system of communication is incomplete, unless pictures play a part in it. This implication is explicitly spelled out on page 174. Wittgenstein here writes, quote, when I say I don't see mere dashes, a mere scribble, but a face or word with this particular physiognomy, I don't wish to assert any general characteristic of what I see, but to assert that I see that particular physiognomy which I do see. And it is obvious that here my expression is moving in a circle. But this is so because really the particular physiognomy which I saw ought to have entered my proposition. End of quote. What ought to have entered the proposition, Wittgenstein implies, is a non-verbal pictorial sign. This is the conclusion towards which the train of thought in the Brown Book in fact leads. And we are now in a position to see that what Wittgenstein in the so-called part two of the philosophical investigations did was to take up again this train of thought. When studied together with the Brown Book, part two of the philosophical investigations goes a long way towards giving a picture of what Wittgenstein's philosophy of pictures might amount to. By two editorial acts, however, an appearance was created which made it unlikely that any reader would attempt such a study. First, people were discouraged from allotting too much attention to the Brown Book, and especially to the later pages of it, by what Rees had said in his preface about Wittgenstein giving up the idea of a revision at a certain stage and calling the whole attempt worthless. Secondly, people were encouraged not to notice the tensions between TS-227 and TS-234 by the publication of them together in a single volume, the so-called philosophical investigations. The volume settled contains quite a number of remarks on pictorial representation. These remarks, however, when compared with the material hitherto covered in my talk, do not really enrich our understanding of Wittgenstein's philosophy of pictures. I'll pass them over. Now, among Wittgenstein's printed volumes, there are four others in which the topic of pictures plays a more or less significant role. These are the Remarks on the Philosophy of Psychology, volumes 1 and 2, and the Last Writings on the Philosophy of Psychology, volumes 1 and 2. In contrast, however, to the books discussed in the present section, these volumes are printed editions of typesplits and manuscripts, which Wittgenstein could not have regarded as anything but a preliminary stock of remarks, some quattro, some taken from older typescripts, to serve as a background for his further work. In other words, the volumes in question should be regarded as the first items of a complete Nachlass edition, rather than as the concluding pieces of Wittgenstein's collected works. Also, the material they contain on the topic of pictures does not add anything substantial to what will already be familiar to the readers of part two of the philosophical investigations. These four volumes, then, I will not consider here. As I tried to show in the foregoing, Wittgenstein's printed writings offer a wealth of important ideas on the social function of pictures, on pictorial meaning, and on pictorial communication. These ideas, however, do not add up to a unified philosophy of pictures. And in fact, the later Wittgenstein, at no stage of his thinking, possessed such a unified philosophy. He had significant insights, but no clear views as to what his problems actually were, or what he was striving to achieve. Hence, he often abandoned ideas his contemporary interpreters might find promising, and many ideas have never made it to the printed edition of his writings. No attempt at constructing out of his insights a genuine philosophy of pictures can, then, succeed without taking account of the entire Nachlass. Using the Bergen edition, I will, in what follows, provide examples of what working with the Nachlass from this perspective might amount to. I will exhibit five samples. I have labeled them Fantasie, Aliska, Philebos, Schlinge und Kinemat, and Kinemat, sorry. I'm dealing with Fantasie first. On page 30 of MS 109, on August 22nd, 1930, Wittgenstein wrote: Dass die Sprache ein Bild hervorbringt, zeigt sich schon darin, dass Bilder im gewöhnlichen Sinne des Wortes sich ihr natürlich einfügen. Die Illustration in einem Buch ist dem Buch nichts Fremdes, sondern gesellt sich ihm zu wie ein verwandter Behelf einem anderen, wie etwa eine Reibale dem Bohrer. Wenn einen die Hässlichkeit eines Menschen abstößt, so kann sie einem im Bild, im Gemalten, gleichfalls abstoßen, aber auch in der Beschreibung durch Worte. On page 199 of MS 110, we find the entry dated June 22, 1931. Wenn man es für selbstverständlich hält, dass sich der Mensch an seiner Fantasie vergnügt, so bedenke man, dass diese Fantasie nicht wie ein gemaltes Bild oder ein plastisches Modell ist, sondern ein kompliziertes Gebilde aus heterogenen Bestandteilen, Wörter und Bilder. Man wird dann das Operieren mit Schrift und Lautzeichen nicht mehr im Gegensatz stellen zu dem Operieren mit Vorstellungsbildern der Ereignisse. These two passages reappear in reverse order on pages 320 and 337 of TS 122, probably 1932. It was from TS 211, 1932. It was from TS 211, Rees edited the selection bemerking Fraser's The Golden Bough, published in the journal Synthese in 1967. In TS 213, the big typescript, probably 1933, the two passages, which I quoted in German, finally come together. This is the text, then, one would suppose, that is reproduced on pages 182 and 183 of the Philosophical Grammar. I quoted the passage earlier. However, the second of the three paragraphs here is missing in the printed version, and a reference to the film that is missing in the big typescript. With minor modifications, the big typescript version reappears again in handwriting in MS-114. It has Wörtern, Bildern und anderem, and the reference to the Reamer is absent. In MS-116, we encounter again in handwriting a shorter variant. The text displays numerous insertions and deletions. The paragraph on fantasy reappears on page 14 of Bemerkung 1, 1945-46, and the same paragraph is printed as central paragraph 652. Here, along painted picture and sculpture, film is finally also listed. Of the paragraph in this form, no handwritten antecedents are known. This is a set of remarks, then. Wittgenstein again and again returned to all through the years, from 1930 to 1948. The fullest version of the set is the one in the big typescript. That version has never been printed, although its message is momentous. Mental operations involve both words and visual images. Pictures are instruments of communication in the same way written texts are, and both in the pictorial and the verbal medium, it is possible to preserve real-world visual information. On pages 153 to 156 of MS-114, written probably around 1933-34, we can single out three mutually incompatible passages. A. Alles kann ein Bild von allem sein, wenn wir dem Begriff des Bildes entsprechend ausdehnen. B. Das Denken ist ganz dem Zeichnen von Bildern zu vergleichen. Passage C we are already acquainted with from the sample fantasy. It clearly contradicts B. So C contradicts B. If the mental comprises both words and pictures, thinking cannot be quite comparable to the drawing of pictures. C contradicts A. If pictures preserve real-world visual information, then it is not the case that anything can be a picture of anything. And B, of course, contradicts A, unless we are prepared to say that thoughts can be the thoughts of anything. A expresses a verbalist or propositionalist bias. B represents an imagistic or pictorialist extremism. C formulates a comprehensive view. One might be interested to find out what the ensuing fate of these passages in Wittgenstein's note was. Alles kann reappears or appears in TS-213 and in the first part of MS-116, that's 1936. Das Denken ist ganz dem Zeichnen von Bildern zu vergleichen does not occur again. By contrast, Wörter, Bilder und anderem, as we saw, is still there in the Bemerkungen war or settled stage. On July 14, 1931, Wittgenstein copied into his notebook and commented on a passage from Plato, adding on the next day a reference to the dialogue Philebus. Following up this latter reference, one gets to a passage where Plato compares the soul to a book, remarking, however, that besides the scribe who writes within us, there is also, quote, another artist who is busy at the same time in the chambers of the soul, the painter, who, after the scribe has done his work, draws images in the soul of the things which he has described. Now, while Plato's dialogues trace this scribe, the traces this scribe leaves in our minds, namely abstract notions, are amply discussed, we find there are no comparable analyses of the work of the painter, that is, no analyses of mental pictures or visual images. Wittgenstein was certainly conscious of the fact that his later philosophy represented a markedly anti-Platonic approach. What these entries in MS-111 make us realize is that rectifying Plato's one-sided handling of the topic of pictures was part of that approach. On pages 4R to 5R of MS-159, 1938, we encounter the following entry. Die Erinnerung ist ein Bild und Worte. Es ist klar, dass diese nur in einer ganz bestimmten Umgebung bedeutungsvoll sein können. Die Bilder können bedeutungslos, die Worte ein leerer Schall sein. Das Symbol des gesprochenen Wortes, Schriftzeichen in einer Schlinge, die aus dem Mund des Sprechers kommt. Dies Bild erscheint uns ganz natürlich, obwohl wir doch dergleichen nie gesehen haben. This reference to the speech bubble, which nowhere reoccurs in the Nachlass, alerts us to the problems connected with the emergence of pictorial conventions. The speech bubble functions like a natural sign, although it is clearly conventional. In the full version of my paper, I have here a footnote in which I explain that the speech bubble or speech balloon is of course a familiar symbol from the world of the comic strips. It appears to have emerged towards the beginning of the 20th century in the American comic strip Cats and Young Kids. That's the Cats and Young Kids, you see the bubbles. It was employed as early as 1901. By contrast, speech bands with texts emanating from the mouth of the speaker are really age old. You see this. This was the illustration which was originally to be seen. And here you see, this is a medieval proto speech bubble. Speech baths like this were already known on Greek vases. This is a very nice picture. And lastly, I mention here that in the speech bubble comics tradition, convention and intuition both play a role in the family. For example, you can see here various forms of speech balloons. And without me explaining the convention, you will realize what the different connotations of these balloons might be. On page 65R of MS 118, 1937, Wittgenstein suggests a way to prove the equation 3 plus 2 equals 5. The proof would consist in drawing a series of pictures or in the cinematographic presentation of the same series, an animation. There is a related remark on page 45R of MS 122, 1939, 1940. Wenn ich sage, der Beweis ist ein Bild, so kann man sich ihn auch als kinematografisches Bild denken. This remark was published in part 2, paragraph 23 of the Remarks on the Foundations of Mathematics, with the word auch left out. When I say a proof is a picture, it can be thought of as a cinematographic picture. The idea of a very different use of animations is experimented with in MS 129, 1944. I'm quoting the remark in the form as it appears in Bemerkungen 2. Denke, statt Momentfotografien unserer Bekannten benutzten wir eine Art kinematografischer Bilder, die eine ganz kleine Bewegung wiedergeben. Und das nennten wir ein lebendes Bildnis, im Gegensatz zu einem Toten, und fassten es nicht als Bild einer Bewegung, einer Lageänderung auf, das vibrierende Leben der Worte. This is an inspired idea. As contemporary science makes us realize, mental imagery appears to be a matter of dynamic rather than static pictorial representations. Still, images are, psychologically speaking, but limiting cases of dynamic ones. With the development of 20th century visual culture, this seems to have become the case with regards to physical pictures too. Now Wittgenstein, at one place at least, made momentous use of the idea of animation. In MS 145, 1933, he asks us to consider a certain proposal as to what a wish consists in, and says that the situation described is not satisfactory since it is not embedded in a proper context. That situation or its elements stand somehow isolated. Wir würden sagen, dass in dieser Isolierung ist noch nicht der Wunsch. Wir müssen nun, um jenes Bild als Wunsch zu denken, es uns im Zusammenhang mit Bildern denken. Wir möchten sagen, ja, das ist das Bild eines Wunsches, also im Zusammenhang mit Bildern. Wie ist es, wenn wir uns statt dieses ruhenden Bildes eine in der Zeit ablaufende Handlung, ein Durchlaufen von Situationen denken? Fühlen wir uns dann von diesem kinematografischen Bild noch immer unbefriedigt? Ich meine, würde es uns seltsam vorkommen, wenn man sagte, das sei der Wunsch? Würde man noch immer sagen, so kann man wünschen? Man möchte sagen, der Vorgang zeigt klarer als die ruhende Situation, was der Wunsch wünscht. This is a stunning passage. What Wittgenstein here in fact suggests is that writing a caption under a picture is not the only way to disambiguate it. Turning a static picture into an animated one might solve the problem too. However, Wittgenstein never returned to this suggestion, and the idea does certainly not surface in his printed writings. It is an idea his embittered adversary H.H. Price brilliantly elaborated in his 1953 book Thinking and Experience. In a series of papers since 1989, I have undertaken to show that Wittgenstein's later work can be usefully interpreted as a philosophy of post-literacy, and that his frequent references to Plato, the first and foremost philosopher of literacy, should be explained as attempts to arrive back at a juncture where Plato took the wrong turn. Throughout its history, Western philosophy reflected the influence of linear written language. Wittgenstein was trying to liberate himself from that influence precisely at a time when post-literary modes of communication began to transform the civilization of the West. Written language as a source of philosophical confusion was Wittgenstein's real foe. He was not clearly aware of this, perhaps since his insights were made possible, to some extent at least, by an impairment, dyslexia. He was striving to overcome the pitfalls of written language by elaborating a philosophy of spoken, oral language. And he attempted to overcome the barriers of verbal language by working towards a philosophy of pictures. It is this latter dimension in Wittgenstein's thinking I hope to have directed attention to in the present paper. Thank you.